WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. I'm Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, August 26th. Manatee.
Can you hear me? Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me? Okay. Great. Okay. I can be heard. How about Rena? Can she be heard?
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to just minimize my window.
You're on right now. 9 o'clock.
Open right now.
I can hear you.
Should be.
The news should be.
Manatee County will invest up to $7.5 million over 3 years in scholarships for State College of Florida students. The money will support the Suncoast Prosper Scholarship Fund, providing last-dollar financial assistance to students pursuing associate degrees and certificate programs. County officials estimate the program could help about 1,425 students. Beginning in fall 2027, the assistance will help cover eligible tuition and required costs remaining after other grants and scholarships are applied. The program is aimed at strengthening the local workforce by connecting students with technical education, apprenticeships, and careers in high-demand industries. In Sarasota County, a proposed change to Florida's homestead exemption could have a major impact on the county budget. Suncoast Searchlight reports Sarasota County Administrator Jonathan Lewis is warning of potential cuts to county services if Amendment 3 passes in November. Lewis told commissioners the county could lose about $134 million in revenue during the first 2 years of the proposal. The Sarasota County Sheriff's Office could face about $54 million in cuts over that period based on the county's current funding model. Emergency services could lose about $17.5 million, while the county's Environmentally Sensitive Lands Protection Program could lose about $8.6 million. The figures are projections. No specific funding cuts have been finalized. And finally, Sarasota is preparing to welcome a major figure in American civil rights history. Ruby Bridges will appear at Booker High School on November 12th for a community town hall. Bridges was just 6 years old in 1960 when she became the first African-American child to integrate William France Elementary School in New Orleans. Federal marshals escorted her into the all-white school as she crossed a major barrier of segregation. According to the Sarasota Herald Tribune, organizers say Booker High School was selected because of its own place in Sarasota's history of school integration. Until next time, I'm Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR news headlines. Stay informed, stay grounded, and stay engaged.
Good morning. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report right here
on your own community radio station,
WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton, and we can be heard live at WSLR.org. And I definitely want to let you know that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station.
So I have a guest,
on the line, and before I... get her in to the conversation, I'd like to read a brief bio, and her name is Rena Kuntz. She's an award-winning suspense author, so she credits her high school English teacher with uncovering her talent for writing. He entered her essay in a contest. It won and was published. Her first byline was all she needed to sense newsprint in her blood. And she turned to a career in journalism, working her way up from a part-time news reporter to a full-time daily news reporter. She has reported for two of the country's top 20 newspapers. Her writing career is taking her into the sports arena, politics, feature writing, editorial writing, and her favorite, cops and courts. She is chased by a truck and police cars, covered all sorts of crimes, including murders, and reported criminal, civil, high profile, and ordinary trials. Many of the ideas for her books come from real cases that she's familiar with. Plus, she's married to a retired FBI agent, and that provides a source for invaluable technical advice, among other things, and he takes credit for her for the steamy scenes in the books. And along the way, she's received numerous journalism awards, many in Pennsylvania and Ohio before she moved here to Florida. And once coming to Florida, she's received the 2025 Silver Medal in the Florida Authors and Publishers President's Book Awards competition for one of her books. And she also won the 2021 FAPA Bronze Medal for Locked and Loaded for Justice, Saving Gia. So she won other awards as well. And so, Rena, are you still there on the line?
Yes, I am. I'm laughing about the husband taking credit for the steamy scenes. You weren't supposed to say that part. But it's okay.
Well, I think we have a little echo. We'll see if we can take care of that as we proceed. And so, Rena, after everything I read about you, when I met you at a book fair down in Venice, I was really fascinated with your background and how your background led to you becoming a renowned author. And I think you've written about 13 books at this point.
That's correct.
Could you give us a sense of what got you going?
I reported various topics. I covered various incidents. But when I became the cops and courts reporter, I sort of found my footing. Perhaps I was fascinated by the criminal mind, but all of my books are based on actual crimes, and most of those crimes stuck with me after I reported them in the papers. A lot of the details, I kept almost all of my notes for years, knowing that someday I wanted to just write these books and tell these stories and have them end the way I wanted them to end.
Rena, could you hold on just a second? I want to
correct this little problem we're having here.
She's coming through there.
And what I'm going to do, I'm going to put a little music on so I can take care of this situation. Number two. Let me put this.
I'm not used to this.
We'll just put on.
I'll put the make tag on.
Drown my soul in liquid fire. flame. For if I drank, the toast should be to blighted fortune, health, and fame. Yet though I long to quell the strife that passion holds against my life, still boon companions may be, but comrades fill no glass for me. Whose patient sufferings need my care. I know a hearth that once was bright, but drooping hopes have nestled there. Then while the teardrops nightly steal from wounded hearts that I should heal, though, oh, boon companions ye may be, oh, comrades, fill no glass for me. When I was young, I felt the tide of aspirations undefiled, but manhood's years have wronged the pride my parents centered in their child. Then by a mother's sacred tear, by all that memory should revere, companions may be, oh, comrades, fill no glass for me.
Go ahead, Rena, say something.
Hello, good morning. Good morning.
Thank you.
Convicted of a murder in Philadelphia, and let me put this on. This is what it's like in solitary confinement. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we're going to play this right now off the internet. So we're going to have the internet ready to go. So this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And know what it entails. I have, and I do. There are basically two kinds of solitary: administrative and disciplinary. The former is usually of a temporary nature or tied to a sentence, while the latter is a response to behavior in prison. I've been in both. For death row is a kind of solitary because of the sentence, death. Guys have spent years doing 23 plus one or 23 hours a day locked up in a cell with 1 hour a day outside. Yeah. Locked in a cage. Think of a cage for a dog. Only the dog usually gets more space. I spent 28 years on death row in solitary. While on death row, I was sent to the hole, or the second type that I discussed earlier, for refusing to cut my hair, where I stayed for 8 years. Remember I said 23 and 1? That isn't really true, because that 23 hours locked up only referred to Monday to Friday. On the weekends, it became 24 hours a day, or the weekend, 48 hours. That was solitary. I've seen men lose their senses and start howling to the moon for hours on end. Other men beat on their metal bunks for 10, 15, or more hours a day, singing songs of pure nonsense for weeks or months on end. I've seen men smear their faces, head, and bodies with feces. until they looked like mud men. But that wasn't mud that they were covered with. I've seen men shrieking, howling, barking, and screaming in an attempt to escape the loneliness of solitary. For the fact is, some men were sent to solitary for over 20 years or even 30 years for escaping or attempting to do so. The great prison teacher, Russell Maroon Schultz, spent over 30 years in the hole for escaping back in the 1970s. Arthur Chetawayo Johnson spent decades in holes across the state of Pennsylvania for being what was called a black militant. That's the word that they used back then in the 1970s. Chetawayo was a child lifer, an innocent man who was 16 years old when he went to prison. He spent 50 years in prison. He's out now, free. Maroon worked with the young men in the hole with him. He taught them history. He taught them how to organize. He shared copies of The Wretched of the Earth, and he taught them resistance for generations. His students emerged to change the world. Finally, what is solitary? According to Juan Mendez, the special rapporteur for torture for the United Nations, any time beyond 15 days, think about it, 15 days constitutes torture. Because it breaks minds. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Welcome back to the Peace and Justice Report. We're having a little technical difficulty here, so I had a phone guest, and I have rescheduled my guest for next month so that we can have the full time that I was hoping to have on her interview today. So with that being said, I have something. I have a YouTube video I want to play, and it's done by Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield is an American psychologist, writer, and teacher in the Vipassana movement in American Buddhism. He's trained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand, Burma, and India. He's worked with some of the leading spiritual teachers around the country. He's been a peacemaker and an activist. He's organized teacher training and led international gatherings of Buddhist teachers, including the Dalai Lama. So he has been around for a while, and he has worked with and done teachings with, as I said, many of the leading spiritual teachers. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this video. It's kind of synchronistic that it was a little anxiety I was having with the phone guest. And coincidentally, the title of the video is How to Dissolve Anxiety. How to Dissolve Anxiety. So here we go. This is Jack Kornfield off the Internet. It's about a 10 or 11-minute audio that you're going to hear. And it's How to Dissolve Anxiety. So here we go. This will be coming right from the Internet. Oh, right. That's right. You got it right, Ron. You got it right. I'm off base here. I got so confused. Here we go. I'm a little, the anxiety is going to come down listening to Jack. Here we go.
Let's talk about something perhaps that many people listening will identify with or at least recognize in their daily experience. And that is anxiety. And maybe we could just define terms and look at anxiety as
that's great.
Fear of the future. You could also define it differently. Could be pre-experiencing the worst case scenario. I really don't know how you would like to define it. But if you wouldn't mind digging into that and share any approaches that you think are helpful, practices, thought exercises for people who are suffering from anxiety, that would be very helpful.
I was going to say that word before you said it, so we're somehow riding some current. We'll see where it takes us, and if we're still in the same boat as we go through the raft.
I'm learning how to paddle. We'll see.
And anxiety is a big but also a really important question, and the first thing to note is that we're living in a time of tremendous cultural anxiety. Even in places where there was warfare or starvation or things when there were very small groups of people, there was still a kind of basic, I know who my family is, I know where the land is, you know, we'll have the food or we won't. But everything is up for up in certain ways. There's a kind of upheaval now of identity, where we live, who we are, and so forth, that's accelerating. And it's been accelerated, of course, for all kinds of things, and now we'll get to it. It's certainly been accelerated by technology. And we're on the cusp on the roller coaster ride. You know, the click, 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 click as you go,
right,
as you're going up to the top.
So you
to
ratchet
start the roller,
up.
Right. And the little sign that you got your ticket for said, AI, go on this ride. So we'll get to that. But anyway, so there's the anxiety. There's the economy anxiety. There's the collective anxiety about climate. There's racial and economic injustice that's really in our forefront. And then there's the human anxiety of our own family and people going through things of loneliness and economic insecurity. So first thing to say, there's a whole bunch of things that might be helpful. The image that I like to start with is an archetypal one of the Buddha seated under the tree of enlightenment. The night of his enlightenment, before he was enlightened, the Indian god named Mara, who is the god of greed, fear, hatred, aggression, all of the forces of suffering, appeared and said, what are you trying to do to the Buddha? And this is the way it appeared. He said, you have no idea what you're dealing with. And he said, let me show you this Enlightenment stuff. And so he paraded before him all the most beautiful dancing bikinis and gilded chariots, the Lamborghinis of the time. And the Buddha said, you know, been there, done that. Thank you. Okay. And then he said, well, you have no right to be there. And he started throwing flaming arrows and swords. And the Buddha lifted his hand and touched them all with compassion. And they turned to flower petals. Cool. Then Mara said, you don't even know who you are. You don't know what you're doing. And there's no reason for you to be sitting here. And then Mara came basically in the form of doubt. And at that point, the Buddha put his hand down and touched the earth and said, will you bear witness to my right as a human being here halfway between heaven and earth to awaken to the way things are?
Can you say that one more time? Heaven and earth or heaven and hell?
Between heaven and earth. Oh, okay. We didn't get to hell yet. If you want to go there, we can go there later.
No.
Halfway between heaven and earth in this human form, be my witness that we human beings have the right to see clearly, not with delusion, not with doubt. And then Mara appeared again, and the Buddha just looked at Mara and said, I see you, Mara. I see who you are. And the minute he said that clearly, Mara dissolved. Now, what people don't know in the Buddhist text is that after his enlightenment, Mara came back to visit the Buddha quite a few times. You think there's enlightened retirement, but Mara's part of the game. And Thich Nhat Hanh has a really beautiful image about this, where he sets the scene of the Buddha sitting in a cave. And again, the Buddha really is a stand-in for your awakened self. Sitting in a cave, mouth of a cave, meditating, and his attendant is there, and Mara appears, and his attendant tries to chase Mara away. And the Buddha says, Ananda, is that my old friend Mara? Set out some tea. Let us sit down. And he says, is that you, Mara? And usually, all that it takes is for the Buddha to say, is that you, Mara, or I see you, Mara? And Mara looks and kind of sadly slinks away, if you will. So the first thing about anxiety is to acknowledge that it's entirely human, that there are cultural reasons for it, and that there are physiological reasons, that we have fear and we have fear of loss and all of those things. And to be able to name it and say, oh, this is anxiety. It feels this way in my body. Your hands sweat, your breath stops, your heart. And it's hard to feel. It's unpleasant in the body. And then it has its thoughts. We'll get to those in a minute. And what you can do in naming Mara, you can say, oh, anxiety, I see you. I feel you. So that's the first thing. And already you start to step halfway back from it as the witness. So that already begins to liberate you a little bit. And then the next thing is you can also say, thank you for trying to protect me. Because if you fight against the anxiety, what that is more anxiety. Oh, my God, I got rid of it. I hate it. But instead, it's almost like you take a little bow. Okay, Mara, I see you. Thank you for trying to protect me, because that's what it's trying to do. And you remember that statement from Mark Twain, where he said, my life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened, right? So these are the stories. You meant sort of the advanced stories. Say, thank you, Mara. I see you. Thanks for trying to protect me. Then the next thing is to know that there's something called the wisdom of insecurity, that it's actually okay to be insecure. My monastic teachers would say, it's uncertain, isn't it? We could ask them all kinds of things. Tell me about enlightenment. My teacher would laugh. He said, it's uncertain, isn't it? He wanted us just to get comfortable with uncertainty. And then what happens is when you realize that you can't know, that you come back into the present moment. And then the next thing to do with anxiety is ground your senses. Feel your feet on the floor, or maybe go out in nature, stand there with a tree, feel the roots of the tree and imagine your own feet as roots into the earth. And notice the wind comes and the storms and all those things happen, but the tree is rooted and it can stay there and you can be the same. You can let the storms of thoughts and fears and so forth arise. So that's another practice you can do. Then you can question your thoughts. And this is more the beautifully spelled out by Byron Katie, for example, who has these practices of questioning your thought. Says, what if that thought isn't true?
Yeah.
How can you know that thought is true? And if you look deeply, you can't know it. And you get to a place of realizing that your thoughts are tentative. They're a creation. And you say, thank you. Thank you for trying to protect me. And again, you become the witness of those thoughts. Then a few more very simple things that you can do. You can find where you feel the anxiety most strongly in your body. And once you feel it, you can feel into its elements. Is it hot or cold? Is it hard or soft? Is it vibrating? The earth, air, fire. So you really get close into it. You can ask it what stories it tells, because it'll have a story. And then you say again, not only thank you for trying to protect me, but you wrap it with kindness, with loving awareness, and say, thank you. I know you're worried. I can respect you and hold you with kindness and compassion. And you know that that's not who you are. This is a part. It's something. It's common for human beings. You say, I respect this. And who I am is honoring you and so much bigger than who you are. And you feel yourself literally being both the witness, the grounded one, the I know you, I see you, Mara. And you become more the Buddha rather than the one who's caught by all these things.
Hmm. Could you say a bit more about asking, for instance, in this case, the anxiety, what stories it tells? Maybe give an example, whether from your personal experience, someone else's, or just a hypothetical, what that might look like. Because that's the first time I've heard that, and that piques my curiosity.
So it's a beautiful question, because one of the things that I've learned all of, over these years is that you can have, the Sufis call it a sobat, a conversation with the heart. And if you let yourself get quiet, it might be after a little walk in the woods or just sitting quietly, taking a cup of tea or something that you like to drink and letting yourself quiet down, or meditating if you want to. And when you get quiet, you can have an inner conversation, and there's information that's waiting there for you to ask. So, for example, since we're talking about anxiety and you want to have a conversation with it, you can say to the anxiety, where do I feel you most strongly in my body? Okay, that's a pretty simple one. Then you can say, ask the anxiety, what is the thing you're most afraid of? Usually it will be something like loss, death, something huge. Okay, say, okay, thank you. Get quiet and say, tell me the story you have about it. And then your anxiety will answer and it will say, well, if you lose your job, which we're afraid you will, you'll be out on the street, you'll be homeless, people will beat up on you, then you'll be in the hospital, or you'll become whatever, and there's a whole disaster scenario. And you can say, yes, thank you, I hear your story. Then there's another interesting question. So all these are things you can ask, and if you're willing to ask and get quiet and listen, usually your body and your heart will answer. And then there's another really important question, or two, that you can ask. What is the most important thing I need to learn from you? And it will give you an answer. I want you to pay attention, or I want you to take care of your financial affairs so I don't have to worry so much, you know, or I want you to make sure you have friends who know where you are, whatever it happens to be, or some bigger story. And then you can step out of the anxiety, and this is a really beautiful one, and get quiet and ask, what is my best intention of how I want to live this next month or this next year? If I only had a year to live, what style? How do I want to live this? Because anxiety also has time in it. And so you're sort of stepping out of time and say, all right, so my time's limited. How do I want to live? What is my deepest intention? And if you pause and ask, your heart will answer.
That was Jack Kornfield, the spiritual teacher, talking about how to dissolve anxiety. And I hope we can all take advantage of some of that information that he gave to us in that YouTube video. You can find Jack Kornfield. His last name is K-O-R-N-F-I-E-L-D. He works with the Be Here Now Network. There's YouTube videos all over the place, Jack Kornfield. You can easily get educated around Jack and his teachings, and listened to many of his talks on the internet. So in my preparation for the show, finding some videos that I could play in case we had any problems with hooking into the first guest, I also pulled up a YouTube interview that I'm going to play 8 or 9 minutes of to end the show today. And this is a guest I've had on the show several times over the years. Let me read a little bit about her. Her name is Kathy Kelly. She's a peace activist, a pacifist, an author, one of the founding members of Voices in the Wilderness, and until the campaign closed in 2020, co-founder, coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. As part of a peace team work in several countries, she has traveled to Iraq 26 times, notably remaining in combat zones during the early days of both U.S.-Iraq invasions, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. From 2009 to 2019, her activism and writing focused on Afghanistan, Yemen, and Gaza, along with domestic protests against U.S. drone policy. She's been arrested more than 60 times at home and abroad and written of her experiences among targets of U.S. military bombardment and inmates of U.S. prisons. So she's experienced a lot of what she talks about in terms of being in prison for a year, in terms of being in the war zone and having bombs dropping around her and seeing the effects of war and how it destroys people and countries. So this is the end of a interview she was having that I pulled up. The name of the site is Purpose, Passion, and Profession. So this is the last 8 minutes or so of Kathy Kelly. And the question that the host put to her was, how can people become peace activists? Do they have to leave their full-time job? What do we have to do to get more peace activists out there? And how do you really get involved to the extent that you would like to? So this is Kathy Kelly answering that question. And here we go, Kathy Kelly.
There were people who took tremendous risks by going over to Iraq before and during United States wars against Iraq, and then came back and morphed into creating a project called the Iraq Student Project. And for the next decade, I watched people work very, very hard to bring Iraqi students over to the United States because they couldn't continue their education in Iraq. And so this was a different kind of valor, but I thought it was required a tenacity and a kind of courage. And then many delegations went over to Afghanistan with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. In the past, well, since the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, I've watched how people have created an informal but very sturdy network. We call it the buddy network of internationals who pair up with one other person from Afghanistan, a young person who had to flee because they were actually were at risk because of Westerners visiting them when we went over there from 2010 to 2019, and have managed to help 100 people make it into safer havens where they're not treated as stigmatized refugees, but are really welcomed. And some of the people that are part of this network are permaculture activists, and some are Quakers living in Australia, and some are, there's a flamenco dancer in the uptown area of Chicago, in Lincoln Park rather. But they work so, so hard to try to build a better world that's predicated on people having real relationships with each other and believing in equality between people. So I think there's no one-way street in terms of activism, and there ought not to be a hierarchy. You know, I think that every place where people can fit in to say, "We are many, they are few" is a very valuable place in which to be. And again, I want to stress, though, education, education, education. Democracy is based on education. You can't have democracy. You can't have freedom of expression and freedom of information and freedom of action unless people are educated about the issues that really are affecting our world, our future, our lives. And so that education might not get mediated through traditional university structures always, but it has, and it often isn't going to be mediated through the mainstream media. But we have to keep on preserving, I'll call it the spirit of a university, the spirit of belief that there's a truth that we can have access to and that we can, well, the way that the Gandhians put it, we can promote truth force, that exposing that truth, and that's what the civil rights movement taught us again and again, help people see the truthful reality of the world that we're living in. And I can say, Janae, that living on the southwest side of Chicago as a young teenager, I remembered being in the Kelly family living room. And when Bull Connor set those dogs on the children in Birmingham and the fire hoses, I watched my own family and people in my neighborhood say, you know what? That's not the side we want to be on. They saw the truth of what segregation was doing in the United States, and it was pretty ugly. So I think we can still count on that truth force to turn people around today. It's a gamble, but I think that we've seen so many dramatic changes in our human history that the big gamble now is we can actually move toward a world beyond war. We've got over 700 bases run by the United States all around the world. And just imagine if each of those bases was converted to doing something good for people.
Yeah. You talked about the Kelly living room, you know, and watching Bull Connor release those dogs. And I'm curious, it brings me back to your childhood. I was reading about the type of high school you went to. You went to like a part parochial, part public, so you got kind of like the benefit of getting some education on religious teachings and philosophy as well as some of the secular. What role did and does your faith play in inspiring your passion and your purpose?
Well, I loved that little high school. We'd literally have mass in the morning and riots in the afternoon. It was a very racist neighborhood. And I think had it not been for the example of people who taught me at that impressionable young age, I don't think I could have ever learned about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King or Phil and Dan Berrigan, or people that wanted to see an end to the Vietnam War. So I was very indebted to people that taught me. And then in later years, people like Archbishop Romero of El Salvador, who aligned himself so closely to the people that were most vulnerable to being maimed and disappeared and tortured and impoverished and starved. A voice like his has, I think, helped steady many, many, many people. And one of the things he said was, in the name of God, in the name of your suffering brothers and sisters, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression. And it was after he said that he was gunned down as he celebrated the Eucharist in a Salvadoran church. People like him and like the other priests that I mentioned, Larry Rosebaum, I think help us to see a road ahead. And, you know, Christianity should never be viewed as better than any other religion. That would be despicable. I don't think that there's any one religion that is more important than another religion. But I would want to remember that the man Jesus didn't die of old age. Via Dolorosa, the idea of, you know, carrying a cross and being willing to undergo great risk is something that I think should be appreciated or absorbed by, embraced by anybody who does wish to say, well, I want to be a follower of that man. And yet, you know, again, I think it's so, so important to say that nobody is able to come back from an afterlife and tell us that one particular faith is better than another, that that's a falsehood that we should never submit to. But I think it's good for people to have spiritualities that they can rely on that help get them through some of the more difficult and dark times in life, and to be grateful for those. And, you know, sometimes I think maybe a faith that can help us all get through is something we might call beingism, you know, reverence for all of being and wanting to save all of being from planetary collapse. And so that way of practicing rituals that would encourage living more simply and sharing resources more radically. And
that's Kathy Kelly. I hope you enjoyed listening to her. This has been the Peace and Justice Report.